I'm Richard Murphy. I'm the director of Tax Research UK. I'm a chartered accountant and have been a business person, but now mainly work on taxation policy. There's an enormous misunderstanding in the public perception of the nature of the financial crisis we've got. The biggest part of that is the lie that they have effectively been sold about government debt, that this is some enormous problem that we have to solve in a matter of months and years at most, as if it is an overdraft where the bank is knocking on our door asking for this money back. That's not true. In the UK in particular, we have 14 years to repay our total debt on average, which is much more like a mortgage, which therefore is a planned liability to be settled over a long period of time. And the growth in the debt is treated as if it is some form of disaster for this country, when actually, again, that's not true. I'm an accountant. A liability always has another side of the story. The other side of the story in this case is that the debt, in the eyes of the government, a debt, is an asset in the eyes of the person who buys the debt from the government. Now, that debt has served an enormously strong and powerfully good function inside our society. Government debt is what underpins all private sector pensions in the UK. We're recording this in 2010. That's exactly 65 years after the end of the Second World War. And the thing that troops did when they came home from the Second World War is get about making babies like we'd never made babies before. Those people are now retiring. We are going to have a very strong and continuous demand for UK government debt for quite a number of years to come, as those people retire, want to buy an annuity that underpins their pension, and therefore will be seeking more and more government debt. In that case, there is a market in this country for that debt for a long time. We have no problem selling it. And the thing that the government is obsessed about, the amount of interest we're going to pay, is not bad news, it's good news. That interest is what is going to keep those people in their retirement. That is literally their pension income. So we need government debt at this moment. It so happens we're issuing some at exactly the right time to meet demand from the market, and the interest is what is going to keep old people in comfort in their retirement. What is wrong with that? I don't know. So the idea we have to eliminate this deficit, reduce the debt, get rid of this interest, is actually, in a sense, going to precipitate another crisis. What are private sector pensions, which everybody is being forced to take out, going to be based on if they're not going to be based upon this debt? I'm really worried about the mis-selling of this idea about debt. It's very strange that the markets are sending out this message time and again that there is some form of crisis that might arise with regard to their ability to buy debt or their willingness to buy debt. I don't understand the basis of that, because there is no government at the moment in the world, including the Greeks, let's be totally honest, who is not able to sell their debt. Okay, their price is high, but our price is very low. Real interest rates in the UK right now are very low on government debt. They've been falling. That's not just since the election. They were falling during the election campaign, so this is not a consequence of there being this particular government in place. It is clear that there is confidence that the UK is able to meet its debt obligations. And let's be clear, even if the government could not sell its debt in the marketplace, that does not mean it could not finance its obligations. There is, in the UK, a bank that will always buy the government's debt, and that is the Bank of England. It is impossible for the UK to default on its debt, because the Bank of England can always buy its debt. Now, the immediate retort to that is, inflation will be on its way because that is in effect printing money. And it is true, that is in effect printing money. But because we have significant unemployment, 2.5 million people, and with every prospect that that number is going to rise, nobody thinks that number is going to go down at the moment. I mean, I suspect it's going to go to 4 million. That's at the high end of estimates, but most people think it's going to over 3 million. There is no price pressure from wages. There's no pressure from pricing, apart from perhaps oil, but oil prices look to be pretty stable at the moment because demand in the world economy is low. So there's nothing which is creating inflationary pressure, so we can issue that money without problem. Why then the markets are saying this is hard to work out, unless it is entirely and purely politically motivated, as part of a belief, which is shared by certain sectors of the political world, that we should now be restructuring the whole nature of society so that the role of government in society is reduced. If you look at it in the context of political economy rather than pure economics, it makes sense. In terms of pure economics, this makes no sense at all. one of the extraordinary things that is happening with regard to the debate on how to deal with the deficit, and at some point we will deal with the deficit, is that the focus is entirely on cuts. 80% is meant to be paid for by cuts. According to the Treasury, it would be impossible, on the briefings I've had, for more than 65% of anything to be dealt with by anything other than cuts. They don't believe there is scope for tax increases to cover more than 35%. The government has chosen to make it 80% by cuts, and taxation is apparently a side issue. Now, that's very strange, because if you look at the actual plot, income and expenditure of government, tax receipts as opposed to expenditure, from 2000 to 2007, we actually saw both rising steadily. But actually, the ability to collect tax was there. The tax revenues were lagged behind spending. But if you'd looked at this as a corporation, you'd have said that was actually simply borrowing to fuel increases in working capital as the scale of economic activity increased. And there would be nothing surprising about it in a corporate analysis sense. But what happened in 2008 was, of course, it was taxation revenues that collapsed. It was not spending that suddenly went out of control. Spending has actually remained remarkably consistent in its growth profile. So it is taxation revenues that fell by something like $175 billion, way disproportionate to the fall in GDP in that period, incidentally, which is something we need to look at as to why tax fell much more than GDP did. And it is only slowly recovering. But there appears to be no willingness to go out there and say, we raise tax to deal with this crisis, we do not make cuts. Well, there's no willingness at the moment. There may be when they discover they can't impose cuts of the order they're looking at. I have argued that, in fact, we don't need any cuts at all to deal with the scale of deficit we have. We can do two things. First of all, there are plenty of tax increases that are available. They would be progressive. They would undoubtedly, therefore, hit the best off in society most. I don't pretend otherwise. They have the greatest capacity to pay. And they also use tax avoidance more than any other sector in society as well. And when there's going to be pain, cutting out tax avoidance appears to me to be very important. I suggest there's $25 billion of tax avoidance or thereabouts in the UK economy. All these things are, of course, estimated. We could improve the revenues collection of late paid and bad debt. Unbelievably, that's £28 billion at the moment, according to the revenue's own figures. Money they're not getting on time, which we're therefore having to borrow instead. It's another way of plugging some of the borrowing is simply to get people to pay, and they don't have the right systems to do that. But by far the biggest component in our tax gap in the UK at the moment is that we have £70 billion, I estimate, of tax evasion in our economy. And yet the government is assuming in the Office for Budget Responsibility report for the next 5 years that that figure will remain static. There are two things to say about that. First of all, it's going to stay static because the revenue is cutting 25,000 of its staff as a spending cut, which means their prospect of tackling that issue is remote. The people won't be there to deal with it. And secondly, during the course of any recession, and I believe we will be heading into recession again, there is always a rise in the shadow economy activity as people who are made unemployed undertake marginal economic activity, which is untaxed. So to presume that that ratio is static over the coming years is actually a major flaw in their forecasts anyway. But we therefore are facing a situation where basically tax, which has the opportunity to deal with this issue in a managed environment which the government can keep under control, is being ignored, while they're proposing cuts of 25%+ in the spending of some government departments, which frankly, as somebody who has run businesses and has run budgets and has looked at reorganization of organizations in my time, I can't imagine how they're going to deliver. Why they've chosen the wrong mechanism to therefore deliver reform frankly beats me, unless we come back to the issue that this is purely politically motivated. It is not a rational economic decision that we're seeing here, but a desire to reduce the size of the state, which overrides their rationality in the decision-making process they've undertaken.
How significant is the threat of people simply leaving this country, making use of tax havens to avoid any attempt to tax their income, which seems to be the sort of counterpoint
There's a regular argument put forward that we can't tax in the UK because the wealth generators, those who gave us the banking crisis, in other words, will leave the UK, relocate to a tax haven, and will lose the tax on their income altogether. And the argument is better to have something from them than nothing at all. That argument is entirely bogus. In 2008, the last year for which we have data, when, of course, the crisis was developing, I think the numbers run into 2009, just 1,000 people from the UK financial services sector applied to work in Switzerland. All the stories that Swiss school, English-speaking schools are full is actually untrue. It appears that for every 50 people who will be saying, I'm going to leave, maybe one does. Well, for every one of those who leaves, let's be candid, somebody comes here anyway, because London is the epicentre of world finance. People want to come here for the experience to be put on their CV. There's no shortage of applicants. Let's be totally honest, it doesn't matter whether these people are a little bit transient in the way in which they work. We can afford them to go. So this argument that the rich will leave, it has no evidence to it. And one very good reason why there is no support for it is that, in fact, living in a tax haven is a thoroughly miserable experience. You've got to actually leave the UK, very, very seriously leave the UK. Guy Hans, for example, a private equity operator, has tried to make sure he's not tax resident in the UK and admits he can't even come and see his children in the UK at a school play, he can't come see his parents. Most people do not have that degree of discipline to say, I will leave and not come back to prove I'm non-resident. With regard to companies, we have a totally different issue. Because it is also suggested that unless we're very generous to companies, and the new government that we have is being very generous to large companies, but not small ones, I stress very seriously the difference. Banks, which already have effective tax rates in the UK of 21%, are going to see a 4% cut in their corporation tax rate, meaning that it's likely by the end of this parliament they'll be paying tax at no more than 17% on their profits, way less than the basic rate of income tax, which will apply to most ordinary people in the UK. Those organisations are paying very low rates of tax and the government is giving into them because they say we will also relocate and we will go to a tax haven. Here we have a much more serious problem, because whereas physically relocating a person is quite hard because they've actually got to find a space on a tiny rock in a tax haven somewhere where they actually can face living, relocating a company is very easy in theory. Because a company is tax resident where its central management control is. And what that means is where the board of directors meet. Now, this in itself is a completely ludicrous concept dating from the age of the steamship, fundamentally, that it was quite difficult to travel. So where the directors were was where the company was, and this was established in 1929 in the case involving Egypt. And an Egyptian company was deemed to be resident in Egypt and not here because that's where the directors were. Well, now you can get to Egypt and back in virtually a day. So you could have a board meeting in Egypt if you wanted to and come back and, you know, be at Heathrow in the evening, having left in the morning. If you're actually going to relocate to Ireland, easier still, you can leave Heathrow at lunchtime, be back from Dublin in the evening and claim to have had a board meeting in which all the important decisions made by your organisation have been made, which, let's be candid, was all decided in advance and initialed while you were there, and that is enough to apparently relocate your company. Quite clearly, we need to move this whole concept of company residence, where companies are located, how we tax them, out of the 19th century when some of these rules, or the early 20th century when some of these rules were created, and into the 21st century where we have the modern era of travel and the whole electronic environment in which companies exist. So we have a massive conceptual issue to face with regard to how we determine residence for individuals and companies to make sure that we capture the tax base, particularly of the high earning in society, to make sure that we really do achieve justice so that all pay their fair share for the economy we want. One of the key things that has been called for by all sides in this debate is increased transparency within the financial system so we can understand better what is going on. Now, it's quite curious that to actually find any useful definition of what transparency means in these cases is rather hard, and it's an issue I've actually been working on of late. I haven't got time to explain that, but one of the things that I want with regard to the banking sector in particular is something called country-by-country reporting of their activities. Now, country-by-country reporting is an idea that's been around now for about 8 years, mainly with regard to the extractive industries, but now needs to be applied to banking and, in fact, I think the entire corporate world. And it says that a multinational company shouldn't just produce one global balance sheet and one global profit and loss account, which assumes that there is one entity out there that floats free and above all states, which is a complete nonsense because, of course, it doesn't, but actually says the activity of a corporation is rooted in the state amongst real people who are its customers, its suppliers, its employees, and so on, and says that that corporation should produce a profit and loss account for every single country in which it has an operation and a limited balance sheet, so that we can tell what it is doing within that state, what level of sales it is making, both intra-group, which is incredibly important because 60% or more of total world transactions on cross-national basis, cross-border basis, are actually between companies under common control, and they disappear from consolidated accounts. So we want intra-group sales and third-party sales by company, intra-group purchases and third-party purchases. How many people have you got there? How much profit do you make there? How much interest do you pay there? So we have a very good view of what the corporation is doing in a place. And I'll give you a very good example as to why we want to do that. If, for example, a corporation has a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands where all the transactions are purchases on an intra-group basis, all the sales are sales on an intra-group basis, there are no employees and no assets, but an enormous profit and no tax paid, this just says this transaction has been constructed for artificial purposes to secure a tax advantage. Now, the very fact that we have the reporting will in fact eliminate some of that abuse, which by itself will mean we'll never discover as much abuse as I think is out there right now, but that's great. I don't mind if we eliminate it by having transparency on those transactions. But secondly, those that remain will be subject to challenge by taxation authorities, will be saying, this doesn't look right to us, and the companies will effectively be self-confessing their use of tax haven locations and how they're trying to avoid tax. This will make them much more accountable to their tax authorities, to the people of the world, to the press of the world who are actually very good at exposing these risks, and that will enhance transparency in a way that I cannot think anything else will.